0967 Real 2.
Well, Mike said Real 2. You were saying you thought it was meant to get the chaps out.
Yes, to get the chaps out and sort of, so they got to know each other and understood the chain of command. Even the VCOs were new to each other. And I suppose it was a sort of team-building exercise. It was still very much recruits, I think, at that time.
How did you find the Pathans to command?
I liked them very much. They had a very good Subedar Saab, who was in charge. He was a good chap, and they enjoyed this. The man that had been in charge of them was one of the regulars, Robin Morris, and he could speak Pushtu, so they had a great affection for him because he could speak Pushtu. They obviously regarded me as sort of second choice, but it got on very well.
What were their qualities as soldiers? How were they different from British soldiers, for example, in their strengths and weaknesses?
Well, I hadn't had any experience of British soldiers, really, in fighting. I would think they were very similar to British soldiers in their attitude. I think Indian troops generally are more effervescent, probably, than British troops. In other words, if you're in a tough spot and you've just got to sit down in a shell hole or a bunker and have the enemy throw bombs at you, it's probably better to be with British troops. Indians can't see any point in sitting there being thrown and having bombs thrown at them. If, on the other hand, it's a question of going across rough country into enemy fire, then the Indians, I think, can do it as well as, perhaps better in some ways, than British soldiers, who don't really see any point in just running straight into a bullet. But that's a generalisation. I mean, it varies an awful lot. I think in the 14th Punjab, you had a quarter Pathans, quarter Dogras, quarter Sikhs, and a quarter Punjabi Muslims. In other words, half the battalion were Mohammedans and half were Hindus. And they got on remarkably well, but I think this was probably all part of the design, the design of divide and rule. If the Mohammedans got up to any tricks, you could generally expect one of the Hindus to let it be known to the officers, so to speak, that this was going on, but as between themselves, it was our battalion, and we were all in it together. There wasn't very much fuss about things, I think.
Well, what was their regimental insignia? Did they have special colours or badges?
Yes, the 14th Punjab is a 14 on a sort of star. I've got it, a hat badge on that one.
Whereabouts did these Pathans come from in the Northwest Frontier Province?
Yes, I don't know exactly where they came from, but they certainly came from a particular area.
Were they from a particular tribe, do you know?
Yes, I think so.
Were you able to speak to them at all?
Oh yes, because I could speak Urdu, and they could speak Urdu. They liked it because the Robin Morris could speak Pushtu and talk to them in their own tongue. But I think that was one of the strengths of the Indian Army, that everyone had to learn Urdu. All the different castes, Sikhs, everyone else, and the officers had this common language, and they all had to learn it. And the Indians had to learn to write it and that sort of thing, and spell it. And there was classes for the Indians to become literate in writing. But because you were all speaking not your own language, but a language which was common to the regiment, that was something that held you together, I think. I think it was a very good idea years ago to build that up.
Did they ever ask you questions about yourself or about England?
Oh, it's a long time ago, that one. I think they liked to find out about me, what I did, whether I played football and that sort of thing. Not terribly inquisitive, I don't think.
What was their marksmanship like?
Not very good to start with, and didn't become very good even in Ceylon. They were very much country boys come into the regiment. I mean, we had expanded the Indian Army in an awful lot already, went on expanding it. And these chaps could hardly drive. Things like cycles. I remember there was a story of later on when we got into Ceylon, they issued the poor little Dogras with some bicycles. And they were coming down a rather steep hill with a large RAF lorry came round the corner, and these chaps just peeled off. The poor lorry driver sat there, and he just said, a whole company of Dogras come down, some of them whistled to the right and to Paddy, some went to the left, and quite a lot of them got landed all over his thing. The poor chap just sat there and said, I'm absolutely flabbergasted. But I'm really saying that they didn't know how to put on their brakes on their bicycles in those days. The Sikhs were the best mechanically, I think. They were all a bit small. I think army rations, which included a ration of goat, and they came, built them up no end, this one.
It's surprising that you said that the Pathan's marksmanship was not so good, because in the tribesmen on the frontier are supposed to be very good marksmen.
Yes, they are. They are, but I don't think these chaps are very good at all on this one. I mean, they're not as good as that. But one of the things, of course, they did know was to not to let your cartridge case get into the hands of the enemy, because the enemy could do it on the frontier, anywhere in North India, to begin in the peacetime. If they could get hold of cartridge cases, they could fill them up again and shoot them back. So whenever we won any exercises, blanks, the whole thing was held up while one of these chaps was grovelling around on the ground, looking for his cartridge case, which had jumped out of his gun and perhaps gone under some grass or something like that. And they couldn't really understand how it was that we were so indifferent to this. I mean, the Japanese Luger had got hold of these things, they could fill them up too, so you had to look after these very carefully.
Were they trustworthy troops?
Yes, I think so. I think they were very good. I'd have trusted them anyway on this one.
Where did their loyalties lie? I mean, what made them fight against the Japanese?
Well, I don't know. I think it was just the army. They were very pleased to get into the army, of course. It had been regarded as a matter of honour to get into the army, in the Indian Army. And when there were only four battalions in the 14th Punjab Regiment, because that, I think, was how they went in peacetime. They had 1, 2, 3, 4 14ths, that's of and then the fifth one was a training battalion. So when you got up to I was in the 9th, but you had it much higher than that. I mean, we were in the 14th, 13th Frontier Force Rifles was in the brigade at one time. You're diluting it down quite a bit. But you're still getting the feeling amongst these chaps that they're following a very honoured profession on this one. And of course the senior officers, I think, who were generally regulars, the senior VCOs, instilled onto these chaps that they were very lucky to be in the army, and they were part of the British team, so to speak. I don't think they were ever concerned about in the battalion, and didn't appear to be concerned about the troubles in India, the nationalist movement. I know, perhaps rashly said to one chaps when we were talking, well, we've got to beat the Japanese. After that, I want to go home. And you must sort out between yourselves what's going to happen in the future.
What was their response to that?
Just quiet, I think. Not quite aggressively, but they accepted that, yes. Let us beat the Japanese first. Certainly they fought against them very well.
You said that you were preparing initially for the desert. How did the turnaround to the Far East come about?
Well, when Singapore fell, I think it was thought that if the Japanese still came on westward, then Ceylon might be the next stop where they'd try and attack, so as to seal off the Bay of Bengal. And we were told we were going to be sent to Ceylon.
And how was that accomplished?
Well, I was in the battalion, Morris, who was the regular chap, and I was sent just before Christmas to Ceylon to go. We were told we were going to Trincomalee as an advance party of two, and we got into Colombo, and then we went across Ceylon. I think we went across by train, and in Trincomalee, and we were given the allocation for the where we were going to have our camp. And we waited and we prepared. We went round and saw the different people and made our number with them. And in due course, in the pour of which I remember, the battalion arrived. And I marched squelching through the streets of Trincomalee up to this campsite where we dug in.
How did you prepare your unit for facing the Japanese? Did you have lectures to tell them about the Japanese and why it was necessary to fight them?
I don't think we did.
What were your own duties in Ceylon?
Of the unit, you mean, or mine?
Of your duties, personally.
I was still. Well, as I say, I was with the battalion then, and I was with them for some time while we were getting in, and then the brigade commander wanted the liaison officer, not for the 9th, 14th, who'd already got Ishmael, who was an Indian officer, but for the 9th, 12th Frontier Force Regiment, and.
Which Frontier Force Regiment?
9th, 12th. 12th Frontier Force Regiment, the 9th Battalion. And they were in Trincomalee. They were north of Trincomalee, up towards Kuchavelli. And I was allocated this job to liaise between them and Brigade Headquarters, who were in the fort. And I then went into Brigade Headquarters, and really I didn't come out of Brigade Headquarters except for the odd period when I was for some reason sent back to the battalion until I went to Staff College.
Which division did this 100th Indian Infantry Brigade belong to?
It was in the 20th.
And you became an intelligence officer?
Yes, well, I was first of all the liaison officer, but as such, there wasn't very much to do there, so I used to go around a bit with brigade intelligence officer, and when he became the divisional intelligence officer, I was given the brigade to look after.
What did the intelligence officer duties involve?
Well, he had a section of six, and to really, it was trying in Ceylon. Of course, there was very little to do. You merely tried to understand what was going on in in Burma and the other theatres of war. We did in fact go out on recces all around Ceylon, large part of Ceylon, mapping or following the maps jungle tracks, particularly around Trincomalee, where we happened to be at that time, to see whether the Japanese, if they attacked Ceylon and landed north of Trincomalee, which we imagined they would, could make their way along these jungle tracks. So it was a lot of work, very pleasant work actually, travelling up these trips with our little units and seeing where they went to and whether you could get there and whether you could get a truck along them and all about it. And then, of course, very shortly after, when it became after the air raid on Ceylon had gone away, and when it became clear that we were going to Burma, there were a lot of exercises in Ceylon, and you were involved in those a bit.
How was the Japanese army and the Japanese soldier regarded at that time? Was he regarded as an almost invincible enemy? Did he have that kind of reputation or not?
He never struck me as... I don't think we ever thought of him as invincible. I think we all realised we got to learn a bit more than the people did in Singapore about fighting him. We heard how they had sprung ambushes and things like that. So a lot of the exercises in Ceylon were preparing for ambush. Generally, by chaps who come officers who come out from Ceylon or out from Singapore. And had talked about this. I think we all felt that after preparing to meet him in Ceylon, where all we could do, I think, was to hope that he didn't come, or if he did, we'd put up a good show. But after that, it became a question of getting more used to the jungle than we'd ever thought was possible, because this was what we understood from Singapore they hadn't got used to.
What did these more experienced soldiers in fighting the Japanese tell you about Japanese tactics and what to beware of?
Mainly, of course, that the Japanese would cut off a unit and surround it. And it was no good trying to back out and keep a front. Sort of the traditional 1948 idea of having a front stretching right across the thing. You've got to sit tight if the Japanese would surround you. Which they would, and not to be worried about being cut off for a time. I think too, of course, one heard that the Japanese would, whereas we used to talk about fighting to the last round, last man, the Japanese did. We were told the Japanese would do that if necessary.
If you sat tight whilst the Japanese surrounded you, how were you supposed to maintain yourselves as far as supplies are concerned?
Well, you hope they wouldn't surround you for too long, so to speak, on this thing, that you'd merely stay there after or be either fight your way out if necessary, or someone will fight their way toward you.
Was the question of supply by air mentioned at that time?
Not to a great extent, because no, I don't think so. I mean, it may have been in the minds of the higher command, but as far as a regimental officer or even a brigade intelligence officer is concerned, it didn't really figure very much.
Do you know the dates that you left Ceylon for Burma?
I've worked it out that we left in August 1943.
What was your journey from Trincomalee area to the front line in Burma?
Well, first we went to Ranchi, which is about 100 miles west of Calcutta, I think. And we stayed there until December of that year. I think we were being given new equipment. We were becoming an animal and transport division, so we were getting some more mules. I think we met Douglas Gracie, who became the divisional commander, and of course Bill Slim was knocking about in the background too.
So, apart from the mules, did you get new weapons?
I was in a very good headquarters then. I think everyone was brought up to full strength. It hadn't been we'd got a lot of the mules, a lot of the animals in Ceylon, and brought them with us. We got some more in Ranchi. We were fully equipped, ready for jungle warfare in Ranchi.
And what were the battalions in your brigade?
It was the 9th, 12th Frontier Force. It was the 2nd Border, the 4th, 10th Gurkha, and the Frontier Force Rifles, the 14th, 13th Frontier Force Rifles.
The 2nd Border being the Border Regiment.
That's right.
And when did you actually move into Burma from Ranchi?
I think in December, around about the Christmas time. I don't know whether it was just before. I think it was just before.
What was your journey into Burma? Devious?
Yes, it was. I suppose you probably had records of that from everyone else, but it was by train from Ranchi. And of course, the gauge. I know. I went. I was in charge of a mixed unit of brigade headquarters, some engineers, field ambulance crew. The mixed bag that one would expect with a brigade headquarters. And the brigadier found that he had got to go and say goodbye to his wife, and the major brigade major had a course to go on. So I was put in charge of this lot, and we had to do it from Ranchi. And of course, you went across a river, you changed your gauge on the railway a number of times, so that when you started off with units neatly apportioned, one having a truck to itself, or two trucks, or sharing a truck with someone else, but by the time you got across the river, it was getting a bit muddled. And finally, we arrived at the Brahma Pooch, where we had to put it all onto a boat to go up the river, and everything went into the hold in a great heap, and then it came out the other end and went on lorries up to Imphal. So by the time it got there, it was in a terrific muddle, but it was a jolly journey. I remember the old Sikhs on the river, then it wasn't the company of Sikhs from 1940, it was a number of Sikhs. And they brought their Granth Sahib with them into battle, their holy book. And they got it this down in the most comfortable, coolest part of the ship, and all the VCOs were sitting around it with little young Jawans with their ostensibly keeping the book cool, just waving their wands at it on this thing, their fans. But of course, all the old VCOs were sitting just between it and the fans, so they did very well. I think after that, the Granth Sahib and the oldest VCO were sent back to headquarters with it.
So you finally arrived at Imphal.
That's right.
What was the situation there?
Well, when we arrived, it was very quiet. A brigade was down on the Tidim Road that was in contact with the enemy. There was nothing down on the other road, Tamu, down into the Bavor Valley, nothing at all, neither us nor the Japanese who were there anymore. I say anymore because, of course, when the retreat had taken place, the cars and things with a few civilians and everyone else in it had come up to Tamu, and there they had to leave the cars and walk over the mountains. It was a very, very precipitous range of mountains running north and south between Imphal and the Kabul Valley.
Whereabouts in Imphal was the brigade headquarters set up?
I think on the road to Tamu. We weren't there very long because we came and then started pushing forward into Tamu and then down the Kabul Valley towards Kalewa with the Chindwin on one flank and more like on the and more lake was a river port, and we were gradually working down the thing, just gently working down.
Against any opposition?
No, not to start with.
Did you have any contact with the local inhabitants?
We saw there was a little village called Witok, and I remember we went in there. We saw them all. They more or less pretended I think we weren't there. It was miles away in the jungle, and the most amazing thing was to go into this village and see a Singer sewing machine, sort of just miles from civilization. But they seemed quite neutral, quite indifferent. But I think we had a chap who had been a planter. I forget his name now. He was attached to the brewery, to the headquarters, and he'd go off into find these villages and knew them and could talk their language, of course, which must have been an advantage. And he obviously got on perfectly well with them, and was quite confident that they'd tell him if any Japanese came or anything like that. He was forward of everyone. And Elephant Bill was down south of Tamu, and I went down and saw him down there. He was recovering from a bout of fever, but he was tucked away on this in this thing.
What impression did he make on you?
Oh, very impressive. I mean, he was down there because the elephants were still there. Of course, he got his lot of elephants down in the valley. And I went down to see him because we discovered a map of that part of the world, all the way from Chindwin right down thing, in which was divided up into sections and got numbers on the section. There was all sorts of numbers. And I went down to ask him what these numbers were, and he explained that in the tea company they numbered these sections and they put the numbers on the trees, on some of the trees round to keep, so that they knew how to partition it. And I remember he said, "Oh yes," and he told me all about that, which was very useful. And after that, of course, we were able to follow these, or the patrols were able for time to follow these things on the trees and find their way about inside without coming on the tracks at all. And I went down to ask him about the tracks over there, because some of them were sort of not always as they were on the map. You were impressing me, I remember, by saying, "Oh yes, I know that. You've got to be careful." He said, "I was coming back one day, and I was sitting..."